Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher and writer, film programmer, and podcaster Carolyn Morissette. Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Cheech and Chong, Murphy and Hall, Myers and Carvey, Frost and Peg. We love watching hapless buddies struggle through adversity and ultimately triumph. And although a lot of buddy comedies we most remember are about men, today we're going to give some love to women comedy duos, looking at two buddy movies that were released in 1997 that have some striking similarities, including far-out fashion and pivotal dance numbers. But before we get into that, Carolyn, when I brought up the idea of talking about female comedy duos, you had some really great suggestions of people we don't often discuss.
Yeah, like, I think there's kind of a renaissance of kind of Black women in comedy, like Issa Rae with Insecure. We've got a Black lady sketch show, which is, oh my God, yeah. It's like the best. You know, then there's like Living Single, the old school shows, A Different World. And I don't think people kind of think of this, not top of mind. Everybody thinks of Friends or, you know, even Laverne and Shirley, Mary Tyler Moore. And I feel like there's like a Black kind of equivalent out there. And it's very close and near and dear to a lot of Black women. A lot of my Black girlfriends are a heart, especially Girlfriends. That show, for me, was so relatable, like between Living Single and Girlfriends, it was so relatable. So yeah, I think that the Black women in comedy, sometimes we don't focus on it. I think one of my favorite things about Black women in these sitcoms or like a Black lady sketch show is that they're so precise. The precision with which they totally drag what we do as Black women or what happens to us, it's so incredible. And like, I'm crying because I'm like, I can relate to that. And also, you know, it's written for women, Black women, by Black women, but also everybody else can kind of relate to it because there's something relatable for everyone. But I know Robin Thede, I was actually able to do a group interview with her. And she's like, you know, we write for ourselves. We write for Black women. And if you get it, that's cool. But, you know,
yeah. I feel like at least when I was growing up, and I think, Carolyn, we're of the same kind of generation. These shows, you know, when we were little, were kind of only on BET or on very specialty cable networks. And the biggest difference I see now, and I'm so thankful that I have more exposure to shows like that you're mentioning, is anyone can watch these on Netflix. We're seeing something like This May Destroy You get giant presence. Global presence in a way that a show, you know, of a similar theme, although I don't think that would have ever been tackled in the 90s, absolutely would have been relegated to a specialty network.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Insecure is still on HBO. Yeah. I mean, that's more accessible now, but that's one of the reasons why I got it. And a Black lady sketch show, I'll admit, I wanted to see my shows, my stories.
And they're prime time too. Like, I know when we talk about HBO, obviously I'm streaming it anytime I want. But in terms of cable, they're prime time shows. Whereas I remember, you know, in the 90s watching HBO at like 2 a.m., that would be also the time that those kinds of shows would be relegated to, is like the not prime hours.
Now, Alicia, if we're looking historically at female comedy duos, what are we looking at?
I mean, historically, obviously there's a lot of precedent in vaudeville, but you know in the early sound era, you had Joan Blondell and you had Zazu Pitts and you had these very bubbly, I would say not obviously very beautiful women, but that wasn't their aura. It was that they were kind of odd looking you know, women, and they would have these great sort of banters. And I see so much of the DNA of like Amy Poehler and Tina Fey in those kinds of duos, where it's very burlesque, where they're kind of talking back to the audience and having their own sort of moment in terms of gender norms. Think about Rhoda and Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, all of which comes up in our first film over and over again.
I'm the Mary and you're the Rhoda.
I really love that as a battle. And then, yeah, look at, I mean, look, the shows that Carolyn are talking about are so fantastic. And if you go 10 years prior to that, something like Broad City, I mean, all that DNA is there in the 1930s, if not even earlier in vaudeville.
Sometimes a comedy duo is originally great, and sometimes greatness is thrust upon them. Romeo and Michelle's had their origin, believe it or not, in the theater with a play called The Ladies' Room. And although Lisa Kudrow was part of the original cast, it would take just under a decade and one of the most successful television shows of all time to bring two of California's most famous airheads and their fashion to the big screen. But we're going to get into that. Alicia, are you like a Romeo and Michelle's fan from way back?
I wasn't. I think it was kind of a sleeper hit. So I didn't feel like it was very accessible to me when I would have been 13 years old when this came out. But I do remember seeing a lot of sort of the equivalent of 1990s memes or early 2000s. I don't know what those were, but a lot of the time after time dance sequence with Alan Cumming, Mira Sorvino, and Lisa Kudrow, I feel like was on VH1 all the time as like best dance scenes of, you know, the 1990s. So I knew it from that sequence. And I didn't really sit down with the film again until researching A Year in Film this past season. And I get it now. Like, I see how transgressive this film is in some ways. I see how celebratory this film is. I also am just like, this is a 90s time capsule in a way that I think even supersedes something like Clueless. Because this is actually what women who didn't have a ton of money, who couldn't afford Armani and all the things that Cher is wearing in Clueless, this is what they wore, was shiny, probably super flammable fabrics that they sewed themselves with lots of trim that they got at like White Rose or Lewis Craft. Like this really related to me. Jelly shoes, like all the terrible chunky highlights. This is 1997. So watching this, I was so pleased to see so many of my horrible fashion choices represented so lovingly and so realistically.
They're all back. If you go into a store again, you're going to see this spaghetti strap, a tank top dress with like this t-shirt underneath. It's all there, honey. We're that age.
Getting in trouble at school for showing a bra strap, like that era. This is very much that film. And Cher and Clueless and Dion weren't that. They were so meticulous and so curated and
sophisticated.
Yeah, they're wearing like $1,000 pantsuits. I believe the costumes in this film is being made, and I realize I haven't even gone into the plot, but Romeo and Michelle are about two girls who were kind of, I don't want to say losers because I don't think they actually were, but they were viewed as losers in high school. Michelle definitely was quote unquote fat, which I find hilarious because it's Mira Sorvino and she's still like a size 2 in those scenes, which is really annoying. And then Romy, who, no wait, I have those reversed. Do I have them reversed? Which one's Lisa Kudrow? Which one's Mira?
Lisa Kudrow is Michelle. Romy is, yes.
Mira Sorvino is Romy, fat in high school.
Yes.
Lisa Kudrow has scoliosis in high school playing Michelle and has to wear like a back brace and sometimes because it's magnetized gets stuck to various objects. And, you know, they want to be the cheerleaders. They have crushes on the football players and, you know, they are humiliated at their high school like prom/graduation. And so 10 years later, we kind of flash forward. They are living in Los Angeles. They are semi-employed or kind of underemployed, I would say, you know, living together as roommates, don't have relationships. Their strongest relationship is with each other, which is the strength of this film. And they get an invitation to their 10-year high school reunion. They kind of come to realize in the process of trying to lose like 20 pounds in 5 days and fake that they're successful that they aren't. So they make up a story that they invented post-it notes. Gets me every time, which is actually someone else did that. Arthur, I believe his name is Arthur Fry.
Oh, this comes actually from the Monkees. One of the members of the Monkees' mother invented liquid paper. And she was like, what a weird claim to fame, which is why she went with post-its.
I like that a lot. Yeah. And so they're going to fake that they're successful. They're going to dress differently. They're going to go to their high school reunion. They're going to, you know, get the guys that humiliated them 10 years prior. They're going to, you know, deal with their bullies. And it doesn't go all as planned, I would say.
You feel good and warm and fuzzy at the end. And my personal icon, Janine Garofalo, is in this film. And she gets her cowboy at the end. So for Alberta me, this is everything that I need. I am right there.
Yeah, she's really good in this. She's almost playing herself, I would say, in some way.
Yeah.
Okay, cowboy, I don't know what your trip is, but if this is some kind of a sick game...
What? No.
If you fuck with me in any way, I will rip each and every appendage from your body, starting with your dick. Capiche?
Look, I just wanted to talk.
Okay.
Did you grow up with this, Carolyn? What's your relationship? I mean, I should say it's also a Disney film, which automatically meant it wasn't successful.
Yeah. Well, how old was I? I was in the clubs that age.
Okay.
I think it was clubbing that age. Yeah. So, yeah, I think I could relate to them going to the clubs and looking for guys. And, like, it's true. We would, my girlfriend, so I was a club kid, full disclosure. I was out in the clubs. I don't even know how I graduated university.
Amazing. I was You're like, that smart. That's how good you are.
I don't know how I did it because we were, okay, so, and I worked at an ice cream store. So I worked every weekend, every holiday that was ever created. I went to school Monday to Wednesday. Well, I went to school and then Thursday to Sunday I was in the clubs. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how I did it. Anyway, so we would go to the clubs and we didn't have a lot of money. So we would go to like Le Chateau or Stitches or anywhere else that had cheap clothes. There used to be a cheap clothes store on Queen Street. I think it was called like Smoochie or something like that. Okay. And they had like these, just this, like, it seemed like people were just sewing these random pieces
like
of cloth
tube dresses,
together.
Right? It was a lot of like very easy patterns to make quickly. Like I said, lots of flammable material that is no longer allowed.
Queen Street of this time also seems very like Melrose at the same time there. Cause like these women are wearing like vintage stuff from Melrose where like, have you ever been to that place where like they literally on a Saturday morning at like 10 a.m. just throw whatever clothing they have sitting in the back in these giant bags out in the parking lot and you just sift through whatever you want. And you're like, this is how I get bed bugs and this is how I die. Like, I feel like that's the same thing.
Well, and like you throw an outfit together and you go out and then we used to get so much shade from the doorman. Oh my God, I remember that crap. Garbage. Anyway, so, but that's a club in Toronto. Like, that is a club in Toronto back then. But yeah, I could relate to them because they were going out. And I could also relate, I was not popular. I hung out with the yearbook group, mm-hmm. who I'm quite proud to say I'm still friends with. Like, they're lovely, lovely people. But we weren't, like, the cool kids. So, and... I just kind of could relate to that. And actually, I think we did have a high school reunion and I was like, I'm not going to
that. That's my worst nightmare. No.
Andy and I were actually, my partner and I were actually talking about this the other day, is that like the focus and obsession on the high school reunion is very much an American thing. It's in all these American movies. In Canada, I didn't have a reunion and I can't think, my mom didn't go to one. Like, I can't think of anyone who really had one.
My mom did. I have a memory of my mom going to her, it would be her 20th, I guess. Wow. Yeah, 38.
Interesting. Because how often do you have them? Like, what is the milestone you were allowed to have a reunion at?
It's like every 10 years, I guess. I mean, I guess the other thing is, I don't think they're as relevant, even in the U.S. now, because of things like Facebook. Because you think about the time that this film takes place and the time my mom's would have been in the early 90s. It would have been that no one has really an ability to stay in touch outside of letter writing and like sending your, you know, annual Christmas update. I think that I can't imagine high school reunions being as popular now that people can just like be on Facebook and see everything that everyone is doing. Like, it's perverse. So I wonder if that culture has died down a lot in the U.S.
I'm sure. This is a movie, as you mentioned, this is very much a time capsule of the 90s. And I think one of those is this idea that, I mean, this movie I don't feel could have been made in the 80s or the 70s because there is this idea that women have to have their own success. And that is within this, right? And they don't do it by going, hey, we're married to handsome doctors and we have four kids and that's the life we live. In fact, that's shown as kind of a bad thing with the Lisa Luter character. Here, it's saying these women are successful businesswomen and that business women lunch special, which is quite possibly the greatest scene ever put on film.
Can we talk
Please
about that scene? Carolyn, what's your reaction to the businesswoman's lunch special?
We need something to go.
Okay.
Do you have some sort of businesswoman special?
Come again?
Well, we're businesswomen.
Yeah, from L.A.
So funny.
I'm like, you're at a truck stop.
Yeah.
I doubt they have a businesswoman special. But I just thought it was so cute because it's like, they're just trying to prove themselves and they're trying to get into that role because they have to play this role at this reunion. So I think it's really endearing. And you see their hair and they've got the French twist mm-hmm. in their hair mm-hmm. and these suits and a truck stop. And I love the waitress. She's like, we don't have that here.
And then instead they just order cheeseburgers, Diet Cokes, and fries, which like...
Yeah. Which the way Mira Sorvino had just won her Oscar for Mighty Aphrodite before she accepted this project. And I'm sorry, she should have won it for saying the word Coke instead of for whatever she was doing in that yeah. Woody Allen movie.
We'll take two Diet Cokes.
Her characterization of like her walking in heels like a lumberjack, which is all intentional. She's like, I want this to be a woman with minimal grace. And I'm like, you achieved that. Well done.
It's such a great act of casting. I mean, so I can't good. Imagine anyone casting. I can't imagine anyone else having been cast in this. I mean, also she is someone who's Hollywood royalty. Her father was an incredibly famous actor, as was her. I think her mother was also a famous actress. She would have grown up elite in Beverly Hills. But also she has that Long Island, New York background that I feel like the character of Romy is so perfectly matched with that California, Beverly Hills elegance and like Long Island, you know. Definitely has an accent that doesn't quite make sense. It's such a muddled characterization that I'm like, I know exactly who she is. And she just had to open her mouth for like a minute.
Well, let's get into the history of how this film was kind of made. Because as I mentioned, this started as a play. Alicia, do you want to get a little more into that?
Yeah, the play is written by Robin Schiff. And I think, I don't know the exact year of the play, but I believe it's like way before Friends. So either late 80s it's or early 90s.
It's 92. Yeah, 92.
Okay, so yes. Yeah. So right on the cusp, basically, of Friends. So this is where possibly, I don't know if Lisa Kudrow was cast in Friends out of this or not, but it was just, you know, a very small off Broadway play that I would love to see restaged today. But, you know, Lisa Kudrow played that role of Michelle. And so it's so great to see her, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, I guess, let me do my math, only five years later. Think about Lisa Kudrow's like stardom, like, that's crazy to think there's only 5 years between the play where she's basically just out of school and like doing a to Friends. And
you know she was
years,
cast in Frasier. She was the original Roz on Frasier and they
yes,
fired her.
Yes, I did know okay. that. She lost. I think yes. she oh. did the pilot and lost.
That
the
is correct.
Role,
they, yeah.
And then eventually got Friends. I mean, obviously that's a pretty good win for her.
Yeah.
But yeah, Robin Schiff is really interesting. I think I would be curious to see, you know, what she's written a few screenplays. She adapted her own play into this film, which I think is partially why it's so successful in its dialogue and its pacing. It's the oddest paced film because you have multiple flashbacks and one of those, you know, and one of the like few scenes that you think is the present ends up being a 30-minute fantasy sequence. It's like, and then we redo it in reality, but it all works. And I think that's interesting because I can't imagine how they handled that in the play when you have characters who would have to dress behind stage to be 10 years younger to do the flashbacks and then also do a fantasy sequence and then redo it as though they were just asleep and that was all a dream. I'm
so
curious
why, because that's not actually what it is. The Romeo and Michelle, the movie, is separate from the ladies' room. So the ladies' room takes place specifically in a ladies' room at a nightclub. And Robin Schiff got the idea because there was two women and one of them actually said to each other, "Oh my God, you hate throwing up. I hate throwing up too." And they were best friends. And that's, it was those like weird communal bonds that you make with other women when you're very drunk and in the intimacy of a bathroom, which I have had. I complimented a woman on her shirt once, which was very provocative. And she was like, "Oh my God, I was so worried about this. I thought it was showed too much." And I was like, "You look great." And the next thing I know, she's inviting me to all of her friends and I'm dancing with all of them. And I was like, this is how friends are made as an adult. world, apparently. So that's what the ladies' room was about, and it sort of encapsulated these two women who were very California, very Beverly Hills, not particularly bright, sort of meeting in this women's washroom as this sort of relation. And then she planned it to be a pilot, that she was worried that you wouldn't want to spend that much time with these two characters. And then word got around they were looking for a female Wayne's World. And then that's when she drafted it out for this. And then it went nowhere. And then Lisa Kudrow made it big and she pulled it out and was like, let's try this now. And that's where it came from.
It makes sense to me that it would be sold on Kudrow's stardom. And then once you get Academy Award winning Mira Sorvino cast, that all makes sense to me that Disney would be like, and it's through Disney's Touchstone subsidiary that they would be like, let's fund this.
How do we feel about the dance sequence at the end? People do that dance at their weddings.
How do you feel, Carolyn? I feel good about it.
I love it. I mean, I dance, you know, when I was more able-bodied, I dance for my cash, okay? I dance at commercials, and I'll sneak up. I live with my sister, so I'll sneak up behind her, and there'll be a commercial on, and I'll be dancing behind her, and she'll be like, you're dancing behind me. Yep. So I used to be a dancer. I love dancing. So this was perfect for me. And also, I think, was that Mira Sorvino a dancer?
She was. She was a ballerina.
She had to be. Okay, yes. I was going to say, is that she's trying to do ballet bad, but when you're watching her, I'm like,
yes.
Oh, you have incredible grace and know all of the moves, and your feet are naturally on point without wearing pointe shoes. Like, they're in bare feet doing this dance sequence. So you could tell automatically that she is, like, actually a trained ballerina.
And when she did those spins, and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. I think she stopped dancing because of a knee injury. Mm. I think I read that somewhere. And you know, I mean, dancers, you put yourself through a lot, so I can see why. You know, and she's so tall, and she kind of gives me that Karen Kane type.
Oh, that's
you
lovely.
Know vibe because
yeah.
She's very tall, and Karen Kane was very tall, and I think that they had some issues pairing her up, and you know. But anyway, I digress. But I love that dance scene because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You're like, why not?
It's also like we're really happy at that point for Romy and Michelle because they've realized that they actually are coming into that high school reunion already cool and good people.
Yeah.
And with strong relationships, and they don't at any point need to fake that they're anything that they're not. And then you get the character of Alan Cumming, who we see both in the flashback as this total nerd in high school who's in love with Romy.
Michelle.
Then we see Michelle?
Yes,
Michelle. Sorry. Oh my gosh. In love with Michelle in high school. Then we see the dream sequence where he's had facial reconstructive surgery and has like a more, and it's actually Alan Cumming in prosthetics, and he's like this tech, like genius, and that's all fake. And then we see him really, and he's just like grown up to be a very like successful businessman with his actual face, which is nice. And then he's the like counterpoint in that dance sequence where he's dancing with both of them. And so it's kind of his success story too, because you could tell he was coming to the high school reunion very nervous, just like Romy and Michelle. Even though he has money, he's the first person to say it doesn't matter. Like all he wanted was Michelle. And he is so good in this. This probably wasn't my this wouldn't have been my introduction to Alan Cumming. I was a big high school crush. I had a big high school crush on Alan Cumming.
Me too!
Which still defines why I have crushes on mismatched men. Let's just he was always very vocal about being gay. That did not stop me.
He's bisexual, from what I understand, leaning towards gay.
Okay, so I've read all his books. I didn't read the latest one, though. Okay, interesting. That gives me hope.
There you go.
But I just had a huge crush on like Rufus Wainwright. Like, just totally ridiculous. It's carried through to my adulthood, trust me. But he's so loving in this. And we also have do we want to talk about Justin Theroux?
God
I
damn
have
it.
A very heterosexual crush.
Here I have a question for you. Is this how Justin Theroux met Lisa Kudrow and therefore met Jennifer Aniston?
No, because he dated Aniston way later than that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She was still married to Pitt at this point, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So I feel like they would have met many times, even without just being in the industry. I feel like they would have met.
Was he on Friends? I think, wasn't he on an episode of Friends? I feel
maybe,
like he was. Maybe.
I'm not I'm not a Friends expert. I feel kind of bad.
But there are so many, like Vincent Ventressa, who plays Billy, he is fun Bobby on Friends. So like there are those little connections there.
I don't think he was on Friends. Because when I Google Justin Theroux Friends, what happens is you get headlines that are Justin Theroux and Jennifer Aniston still friends.
But he's so pretty. And I mean, for me, I don't know about you, Alicia and Carolyn, but like Janine Garofalo was a big turning point for me as a young person to see that you could be acerbic and smart and gothy and still be sexy and a leading woman. Like Truth About Cats and Dogs, as problematic as that film is, was very formative for me as a young person. So it was so nice to see her in this position. And the one issue I really have with this movie is that she's wearing that lemon yellow print dress at the very end of the movie, and I wish they had made something in their style but completely in black for her. And I think that's the one issue I have with that this film. And Mona May, who also did Clueless's costumes, costume design for this.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think I kind of looked at it as, on the like bright side, her realizing that she really actually does like Romeo and Michelle, because she's not very nice to them for the whole film. And I think buying one of their dresses is a nice, like, I've bought many things my friends have made that I have no intention of wearing or putting on my wall, but like it's a nice gesture. But yeah, I get what you're saying, Becky. That does make sense.
And I think the other thing I really think why this movie is so different than any other message that has come before, it's that everybody's life is hell in high school, and even if you were picked on, you may have made somebody else's life hell. And I think that's an interesting idea, and to really consider your actions as you're moving through life. Like again, Cameron Manheim shows up in this as she's trying so hard, and Janine Garofalo apologizes to her because she says terrible things to her and hurts her feelings. And I like that, and it also shows responsible adults confronting their confronting their bullies in a progressive, intelligent way of, hey, you hurt me. Can you say sorry?
Yes.
And that's like, sorry, where did this come from? Great.
And, you know, I think also seeing, and I don't know if you can relate to this, Carolyn, or you, Becky, seeing the people that tormented you in high school, the people that you thought had it all, that they had the body you wanted, they had the partner, no one has partners in high school, they had the boyfriend or girlfriend you wanted, they had, you know, maybe they were had more money than you did growing up, all the things that you're like, oh, they have it all. Seeing that 10 or 20 years later, and thank God for Facebook, seeing what their life is like now is like, yeah, that is not all it's made to be, apparently. there's something to, like, you know, being on the upswing gradually, like feeling like, and I felt I was very unpopular in high school as well, and seeing just like, as long, that was actually a skill, that's now a skill that I have. I know how to be, I know what it felt like to be unpopular, I know what it felt like to feel like a loser, and it's carried me to, I would say, some success in my adulthood, and I'm very proud of that.
That's something we do our best to teach our small person, is that, like, often what makes you different is what's going to make you successful.
Yes. Carolyn, can you relate to that at all? I mean, you sound like you were super, as much as you were like, I wasn't cool in high school, like, by the fact that you were a 90s club kid, I didn't start going to clubs till I was like 30.
Oh, no. Well, you see, my parents were very strict. So all we did were, my sister and I, we read. I have an older sister and she left at 19. So we were kind of left in the trenches. Yeah. So my mother was like, okay, well, you're not leaving home until you get married. And I'm like, uh-oh. We read.
Yeah.
We read and we were good girls. And then when I went to university, I'm like, enough of this. Because in high school, I was not popular. I later learned that there were a couple guys that I had crushes on that had crushes on me.
Yay. That's so nice.
But they thought I was such a quote unquote good girl that I wouldn't go out with them or whatever. They didn't make a move. And actually at my prom, I was like, I'm not going down going by myself. I'm like, everybody thought I was this little quiet, good girl. So I asked the school stoner to go with me. And he was a nice guy. He just looked like this surfer dude.
Hmm.
And I'm like, want to go to prom with me? And he's like, sure. So, and you know what?
You probably had more fun because of that.
Yeah. And he came, he picked me up. He brought me a corsage. He wore a suit. His mother was apparently like in local politics in our neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
And so they had money, but he was just a stoner. And so he took me out. We had a great time.
I wore this, like, I still have it, this silver tank dress. And my hair, I used to have, I had like a long hair, like I had hair down my back.
Yes, so
I
got can you send us a photo, please, if you have
it?
Oh
my God, it's so brutal.
It's so great.
And I was like tiny, tiny, and I actually look pretty good, I have to admit.
I bet.
And so everybody is like, is that you, Carolyn? And I'm like, damn right.
I am here to party, and the party is now here. Let's go.
I love that story. That's
so
great.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I can relate to not being popular. And then just like, I guess in my life now, I still have to deal with, like, I still deal with like that imposter syndrome and like, should I be at the table? Should I be in the room? But, you know, whatever. It is what it is. Yeah.
Don't we all? But I think that's also why this movie connected with people. Like, I think you have found success when people come up to you randomly and quote your movie at you. And this is the movie that apparently both Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino say people quote at them the most. Alan Cummings, for sure. Alan Cummings owns a nightclub in New York called Cumming. And they have a Romy.
I didn't know this.
And they have a Romy and Michelle themed night, which involves 90s music, DJ requests written on post-it notes, and a scarf folding station. So I was like, as soon as quarantine is done and they open up the clubs, we're going. It sounds amazing. Yeah.
Becky, you and I can do a field trip. This is, this could be a tax write-off because it's for the podcast.
That's right.
Oh my God. Yeah, totally. we when I worked at TIFF, we brought him in to do a talk on Eyes Wide Shut, which he has like a 4-minute scene in and somehow steals the show. And most of the audience questions were about Romy and Michelle.
Again,
which
people love this.
During a Kubrick retrospective, which he, graceful man, kind, just, I was so jealous of my colleagues who got to go drinking with him. I didn't get to go.
Oh.
He just graciously answered every question, every, you know, person in the audience who was just fangirling, mostly fangirls, some fanboys, fanning out to Alan Cumming because he was from Romy and Michelle and probably had never seen Eyes Wide Shut ever in their life, and we're in for a treat.
This is what's interesting. So Mira Sorvino actually talks about the box office failure of Romy and Michelle's, but she says part of the problem is because this was rated R. They didn't take out any of these, especially Janine Garofalo's F-bombs are apparently like an instant R, no-go, which you'd watch this now and you're like, no, this is streaming on Netflix and I'm watching it with my 13-year-old, right? Like
it's on Disney Plus, exactly. Not even on Netflix.
And the smoking too, right? There's so much smoking in this. In fact, like the quick burning paper that she invents, that's a whole other thing, right? But it's in, she says that the biggest issue with the box office is that a parent would have to take you and a parent is not going to pay to take you multiple times. And that's how box office makes its money, is people going to see it over and over again. Mm-hmm. But DVD rental sales, if you look at the poster of this, this is the ultimate sleepover buy with the two girls in their cute outfits hugging,
absolutely.
High school reunion. People would have bought this for their kids to watch at sleepovers, no question.
My memory of the weekend, and I could be wrong, you would think I would fact check on this podcast. I do have a computer in front of me. My memories, this came out around the same time, if not the same weekend, as Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery.
That is correct.
Another really interesting example, because its box office wasn't gargantuan. It did quite well, but not like what you would expect. And then on the Blockbuster VHS, we're kind of more in the VHS era at this point, explosive.
Yep.
And I think there's a few titles we're going to talk about from 97 that weren't necessarily box office hits, but because blockbusters were such a cultural center during this year, became, you know, bona fide cult classics. And certainly this film is one of them. It's also, if you think about it, the director is David Merkin. He's of The Simpsons. He's of The Larry Sanders Show. You're going to have that transgressive sort of acerbic comedy that I don't think works in a Disney marketing campaign.
No. How do you cut a trailer?
You know what's really interesting too is that, like, you're talking about Austin Powers and Romy and Michelle, and it's the color, just the color palette. Yeah. That alone will draw like a young viewer.
Yes.
And like the popcorn, the bubblegum pink and the pops of color. Like, I think that's a huge draw as well. It's just fun.
Yeah.
It's a fun color palette.
Agreed. All right. With that having been said, I am going to bring us into our next film, which is also, if you think this is bubblegum, popcorn, everything else, just wait till you see how our ladies dress. We're going to be talking about BAPS coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Some people take the straight path in life. But at Arizona State University, we respect your twists and turns. They make our online students more driven to excel in their professional lives. That's why our personalized suite of services empowers you with innovative resources and staff that sticks with you. Make your next turn with one of our 300-plus programs at ASU, number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years. Visit us at asuonline.asu.edu to learn more.
In 1987, multi-hyphenate director, writer, producer, actor Robert Townsend made a comedy movie called Hollywood Shuffle. Pairing himself with a bunch of his buddies, like Keenan Ivory Wayans, the movie called out Hollywood for not knowing what to do with black actors, casting them in a cavalcade of stereotypical roles. Its scathing satire launched his career as a director, enabling him to make beloved films like The Five Heartbeats. It also led him to make a film in 1997 that had a number of film critics, I should point out middle-aged white film critics, accusing him of directing a film that portrayed its two black female leads as African-American stereotypes. There's a lot to chew on. And this should be a feel-good movie, so we should get into it. And I want to be very clear, I loved BAPS. I liked this movie so much. And Carolyn, how do you feel about it? Tell us a bit about the movie.
Oh, I love BAPS. I am a BAPS stan. I am a Halle Berry stan, have been for a long time. So BAPS is about two women, Denise and Tamika, Niecy and Mickey. Niecy is played by Halle Berry, and Mickey is played by Natalie Dessel. So they're two women. They have dreams. They're waitresses. They don't like their jobs, and they see that there's a dance competition, and they live in Decatur, Georgia. So they see that there's a dance competition in L.A. for Heavy D, and you could be like the video girl of the year, and you could win 10 grand. And that would be seed money for them to open up a salon because Niecy wants to be like a, you know, world-class hairdresser. So they decide to quit their jobs, go to L.A. And when they get there, and these young women, by the way, are dressed over the top. They have gigantic hairstyles. They have very flamboyant clothing, long, long nails,
gold teeth,
and they are ready to go. Yes, the beautiful gold teeth.
I loved it
so much. So good. Yes, I love the gold teeth too. So they were in their whole like outfits, ready to go to LA. They get on the plane. Of course, they cause a bit of a ruckus with their gigantic hair on the plane. They get there, and of course, they're not exactly dancers, so they don't get chosen, but they are. They attract the attention of a young man, and he says, well, you know, if you want room and board and $10,000, come with me. So they're like, sure. They go with him, takes them to this mansion, and there lives a man named Don Blakemore, and his nephew, Isaac, wants to give him his last days. He wants to give him like a really nice, send off because he's ailing. He's sick. So he wants these two women one of them to pretend that she is his uncle's long lost love who was black. So he wants
or the granddaughter, one of the, right?
Yeah. So meandering here.
Because that would make her 80 years old.
Yeah. Yes. Isaac wants one of the women, Niecy, to pretend that she is his uncle's long lost love's granddaughter. So she decides to do it, and they have a nice place to stay, and they're introduced to Don Blakemore, who is the ailing older gentleman, and so he takes them in, and it turns out that Isaac is trying to get his inheritance, and he's trying to set up these two women. So it just kind of becomes like a comedy of errors, and kind of a bit, it shows the morals of these young women and how, you know, kind-hearted and good they actually are. And it's just kind of a silly farce, and it's fun. You know, I don't know if my synopsis was that great, but no, that's, it's just that's a fun movie.
That's the movie. It's really, if this is something that you think you're going to love, you will definitely love it. It's fun. It's over the top. And also, why do we not have more comedy starring physical queen comedy Halle Berry? Like, I didn't know she could do that. She is so funny.
There is a scene that I watched this very early in the morning. And I, like, spat my coffee out. The bidet.
So
the bidet
funny.
Scene. Which I think I've been there. Like, I remember being at my first trip to Europe, like, pretty young and not knowing what they were. And, like, turning on the faucet and not knowing it's going to shoot up into your face. And this is done to maximum physical comedy in this film very early on with Halle Berry just, like, sliding all over the, like, bathroom,
she's
like,
in
doused
a full
in bidet water.
Rubber, like, bright orange rubber jumpsuit, which makes it worse because she's just, like, gliding.
Trying to hold on to the porcelain with, like, and she's so tiny. Like, I can actually see that, like, you know, incredible force of water blowing her across the room because she's itty bitty. And it's like, oh my God.
For me, funny.
Yeah.
For me, it's the she has the bit with Mickey at one point where they're hitting the guy who they now know is a bad guy. And they're talking about how to hit someone like Mike Tyson. And she's just like, bop him in the nose. Like, no, you got to do it like this. And they're using him like a punching bag. It is so funny.
He did him like this.
Oh, no. You ain't see his last fight, because you was in the kitchen getting the popcorn. Tyson would do it like this.
Oh.
I was worried an ear was going to get bit off. That's the only thing in the screenplay that it would have been really funny if, like, Halle Berry or even, like, Natalie Dassel Reed's character, like, bit his ear.
Yeah. And, like, she's like, I'm going to hit you like you stole something. Like, I was done. Like, and, like, for me, it's the dancing, which she's doing the dance off in the lineup.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's, like, my favorite part of the movie. And I think I remember the commercials for this movie when it came out. And I saw that kind of emblazons itself in my memory. I've seen the commercial. I'm like, what the hell is she doing?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a, God, I love this
Halle
movie.
Berry had a name at this point. She'd already done the Flintstones. She'd done Boomerang, etc. She appeared as Halle Berry in CB4, like she existed. However, this is her first, like, leading role. And I think it's so interesting that this is what really defined her up until that point. Like, she was known as sexy, but it was like, no, here's where she does what she can actually do.
I'm going to say that, given the cultural moment we're having for BAPS right now, and a lot of this, I think, can be attributed to Simone from a recent season of RuPaul's Drag Race, who came out dressed in the orange pleather, I guess vinyl outfit with the full hair, like the most beautiful wig, immaculately made. I want to say maybe Gigi Good made the wig.
Probably.
There was a real moment with youngins, with Gen Zs, who were like, what is this? And so if you look at Letterboxd reviews of BAPS in the last 6 months, a lot of people are actually quoting that they watched this because of Simone. You know, obviously RuPaul knew exactly what that reference was, and Simone's very young, so she's someone that would have grown up with this, you know, as a little boy, watching it probably on TV, either VH1 or BET, because I know it aired on BET quite a bit. It's cool that in 2021 we're getting BAPS celebrated in a very global and, like, mainstream. I'd say RuPaul's Drag Race has gone mainstream now. Yeah. The idea that a show like that can bring BAPS to the forefront, I think, is pretty wonderful.
And then everybody is having a good time. Like, I think in any of these buddy comedy movies, regardless of what circumstances you're duo are going through, they always should seem like they're having a good time. Like, it's obvious Mira Sorvino and Lisa Kudrow enjoyed each other's company. There is no question here that Halle Berry and Natalie Dassel aren't having the time of their lives making this film. They are having so much fun, and we have fun as a direct result. Even Martin Landau is having a great time.
Yeah, Martin Landau, right? Yeah. It's crazy.
And that's what I was like, that's Martin Landau. This movie.
Academy Award. I can't remember. He was one for Ed Wood, or
he had. He won for Ed Wood. Yeah. That was his last big one. Yeah.
Like, it just seems like everybody genuinely, they were just having. And that's the thing. Like, it bothers me that this film got dragged so much, because I think there's a bit of respectability politics too in play, where, you know, you see, like, let's compare Romy and Michelle and Babs. And I actually did a little chart. And I did, like, two, like, there's a dance scene, in Romeo and Michelle, there's a propelled by a dance competition. You know, there's like a lot of similarities with the film. And I mean, they both didn't get great, you know, ratings or whatever from the critics, but it seemed like it's easier. And I'm not saying the dumb blonde shtick is not cool either, because that's like a stereotype as well. But I feel like they got away with it a little bit more. Whereas with Niecy and Mickey, they tend to, everyone was saying, well, it's a caricature, you know, it's like, you know, they're pushing the stereotype too much and whatever. But it's like, I take comfort. I mean, I think it's, I don't even know how to put it, but like, you know, in the South, people dress like that. People have gold teeth. I was looking up the history of gold teeth, and there's a whole history behind
this
it.
This is why we love you, Carolyn.
I mean, apparently, I mean, there's obviously like way back when and the historical aspect of it. There's like from the Greek era, like from Egyptian times. But then there's also like West Indians had gold teeth because they couldn't afford to fix their teeth. Mm-hmm. They came over, immigrated to the States. And then American African-Americans was like, hey, yeah, OK, I'm going to wear gold teeth. And it just kind of spread from there.
Wow.
And it's like, and then like, you know, the Southern rap adopted like grills. Mm. So it's like a whole like a cultural thing. So it's not really, it's not a stereotype. People, I had uncles with gold teeth and I was just like, whatever.
Yeah. And these girls are from Decatur, Georgia. Yeah. They are diner waitresses. Like, yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, it's, and the hair, like, they had hair competitions, black hair competitions, which are over the top. They still do them. I was looking that up and they're still like, and they embrace natural hairstyles now. So like, they're very gorgeous and sculptural and, you know, everybody's got the long nails now. I mean, you know, what is it? Nicki Minaj and Cardi B and, you know, all those hip hop, women, they've always had long nails. And now you if you don't go to the salon to get acrylics, what's wrong with you?
Well, that's a sign of, it's a bit of a sign of affluence too, right? Because you can't do a lot of stuff with those talents. So you got to have someone who's going to do it for you.
I think when I was, you know, you're saying this film got dragged and so did Michelle, Romeo and Michelle. This film was brutally attacked. I would say it was more than dragged. This is one of the most famous 0-star reviews that Roger Ebert ever gave. And you know, he is someone who said this is basically a racist film. And if you look at 1997 and those reviews, I think what I'm reading, it was all of these reviewers, first of all, are male and white, all of them. There's like, even Pauline Kael's dead at this point. Like, you know, not that I think she would have liked this film. I think she's dead. Yeah. I should, again, fact check that. But it's interesting because they're upset because they made beautiful, light-skinned Halle Berry black. Right? Like she could pass as like, she's black, obviously, but she could be, you know, she could wear the skinny clothes and the like, you know, be like made up as blonde in certain films and be the kind of femme fatale Flintstones. And she's black, but she's also like, you know, consumably black for a white audience. And here she is black. She is black, and that really seemed to upset people. There's a lot of people talking about her being embarrassing in this film, which I think is a racist comment. That's awful.
Yes.
And she is so funny.
Yeah.
And I love that. I know, very sadly, Natalie Dessel-Reed passed away from cancer in 2020 during the pandemic. And the tributes that Halle Berry paid to this film and to Natalie, who I think she stayed friends with well beyond this film, so 25 years, it really points out that these two women were not treated well. They were not treated well. This film was not treated well. The reviews are ridiculous. There's a really great Refinery 29 article written about this film and how important it is. And so I just wanted to quote a few figures that article says, which is out of 143 movies that were theatrically released in 1997, only 17 had any black performer with top billing. And most of those, you think about, are going to be Men in Black, Money Talks, Switchback. There was almost, with the exception of Soul Food, no roles for top billed black female performers.
Jesus.
And Soul Food is very different, right? Like it's sort of a comfort movie. Like it's great. I like Soul Food a lot. I think it's a lovely film.
We considered it for the podcast.
This is very aggressively different than Soul Food, right? And so I love that this film is being seen again, although it's, I will say, very hard to track down. Unfortunately, it's not on Netflix.
The other thing it does too, which wouldn't have been like available for white audiences, is the amount of people that they run into because they're in Beverly Hills and they're so excited to see all of these different celebrities. But a lot of them are
LL Cool J is the best cameo ever.
Okay, babe, keep licking them lips. Oh, and I know you with your baby's mama, but if the shit don't work out, you know you can come in.
Can I just say, this is my weird piece of trivia. Heavy D, who features prominently in this, if anyone is a Top Chef fan, that is the father of Antonia from Child.
Oh, that's so cool.
That is correct. Yeah. Yes. If anyone, there you go. There's your piece of trivia. He passed away as well, unfortunately. But yes.
You also know it's 1997 if Dennis Rodman shows up in
Yes!
Film. And like...
yeah. And Leon from Like a Prayer. I remember that's one of the first times I saw him.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my music video. Didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Bernie Mac is in this. God rest his soul and how we miss him. Yeah, it's wild. Yeah. And so you have all these references.
We haven't even brought up that it's written by Troy Bayer, who was an actress. I also want to point out she has a PhD in clinical psychology, which this is Dr. Troy Bayer.
That's right.
This is her screenplay, and she does appear as the lawyer in this film. I did notice that she has a book called How to Be a Powerfully Responsible Bitch and Take Your Life to New Heights. And I was just like, is that maybe in my cart right now? Yes, it is. Probably not written for me, but I would still like to read it nonetheless.
Now, we should also say that Trebayer has disowned this film. She says it is not what she intended to write and what she intended out. She said specifically the tone is very different from what she intended. It wasn't intended to be this big and over-the-top slapsticky. And she said that it was a lot of the little jokes were rewritten, which if you're familiar with Robert Townsend's comedy, his stuff is very big. I mean, he's a buddy of Keenan Ivory Wayne's, right? Like, it's very much that in Living Color, sketchy kind of comedy, which I don't think she intended for this. Now, it's also difficult to talk about this movie without talking about the movie Disorderlies. Have you guys seen this one?
No, I haven't seen that.
I want my time
fair.
Back.
Okay, so I have now watched Disorderlies because that is my commitment to this podcast. And I'm with you, Carolyn, that like Three Stooges-y sort of humor isn't for me. It's a Mike Schultz movie, who we've talked about on the podcast before, as being like one of two black directors working in Hollywood for the entirety of the 70s and part of the 80s. And it's the Fat Boys, who are a rap trio that they were trying to make into stars. And the plot is very similar to this one. It is three orderlies who are hired by a rich nephew who needs money in order to, because their behavior will be incorrect, kill through negligence his rich uncle. So he'll get the money faster. But then the rich uncle really enjoys spending time with these orderlies. And they end up showing him like aspects of hip hop, et cetera, et cetera. Very similar plot line to this, and Troy Bayer is in that as well as one of the as one of the like the girlfriends of the characters and like a love interest. So like these two are very companion PC, although Baps is way better, just because
by far
and my personal sense of humor, not into the slapsticky stuff. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to see that she was in that film. The premises are very similar, and then this one is now the translation of that and almost like a reclamation of that for black women, which is very interesting.
It's funny because I was talking to my boyfriend about, you know, doing the podcast today, and he's like, he and she goes, is everything connected to Baps? And I'm like, yes, it is.
That is correct.
It's kind of like 6 degrees of Baps, okay?
Well, I love that.
But yeah.
She also took the money here, which I love when people do this. She took the money here and she went and made the movie that she really wanted to make as the director and the writer, which is Let's Talk About Sex, which I have not seen, so I cannot say anything about it.
I saw it.
Do you have strong feelings about this, Carolyn? Do you want to voice them on the podcast?
Yeah, just a comment. it's kind of like, you know, the first episodes of Sex and the City where they speak to people on the street?
Yeah.
Very much like that. So she wants to talk. She talks about women and their relationships and what they want from men and sex. And there's also some queer characters as well. And it, you know, I did like it generally, but there were just, it's so 90s.
Yeah.
It's like when you watch it, you're like, even down to the lipstick and like, you know, that kind of grayish rose lipstick that everybody wore. And, there's a scene where something terrible happens to the main character. And so she lives with her roommates and there's this montage of them all really upset about this terrible thing. And they're crying and cleaning.
Okay.
And crying and cleaning, and someone rips off her shirt and she's mopping the floor in her bra and pants. And I'm like, I kind of looked it up on it. I'm like, this is not a comedy, right?
Oh dear. Oh dear.
That scene that stuck in my head now for the rest of my life and I can't unsee it. So, I mean, it wasn't a bad film. It wasn't great. So I don't know. I'm glad she took that money from BAPS, but I don't know if I would necessarily connect myself to that film because it was kind of edgy for the time. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, BAPS is just more fun.
Yeah.
This movie was a bit of a drag where this movie, BAPS was fun.
It's celebratory.
Oh. Yeah.
And that's why it's so odd that reviewers would think they would even have a right to think this film is for them, right? White male critics thinking that this film was made for them is utterly ridiculous.
That's interesting to me that you say it made for them, because that is very much a new concept in criticism, is not for me is different than not good.
I mean, if you think about 97, you know what was made for them? Amistad.
Yeah.
If you want to be if you're a white male critic, then Amistad was your film.
Okay, you want to get weird? Here we go. So Ruth E. Carter did the unbelievable costumes in here, and Ruth E. Carter is a name if you know anything whatsoever about costume history.
Spike Lee was her big kind of break.
When she just did Black Panther, that's what she won the Oscar for, and that's why Spike Lee stood up for her at the Oscars, because it was damn time. She also did the costumes for Amistad. That's what she got nominated for. She got nominated for Oscar for that. But like, yeah, her resume is ridiculous.
Are you saying she did the costumes for BAPS as well?
That is correct. That is what I'm
saying. So in 1 year, she did BAPS and Amistad and wins for Amistad?
That is correct. Do you want to see what she's doing in 97, 98? Here we go. So yeah, she's got How Stella Does Her Groove Back, Summer of Sam, Amistad,
oh, those are good costumes.
BAPS,
that's
Money Train. Ooh. Like all of this is all her in a year to a year and a half. That's all her. I mean, this woman's resume is ridiculous and her skills are bananas, right? And I can't believe it took until Black Panther for her to win. When you look at everything, she's also uncredited as doing the costumes for Kangaroo Jack, but I think there was a please remove my name from this one.
Yeah,
but yeah, like it's ridiculous.
And the costumer for the costume designer for Romy and Michelle has a long resume too. Mona May, she has a great long resume too. So I mean, there's so many similarities with these films. I was so pleased when you're like, yeah, let's talk about these two films together because they're so great. And I wanted to circle back just quickly when you're talking about Halle Berry and like they're saying they took her and made her quote unquote, you know, look black. There's a book called Divas on Screen and it's written by Mia Mask. Mm. And she has a whole chapter on Halle Berry and how her biracial identity and her identifying as African-American and how that's affected her trajectory in Hollywood. It's really, really well written.
Mm. Yeah.
It's really fascinating too. And I just can't help but think like also at that time, you know, the black boom of filmmakers. And I think that, again, they probably wanted this film to be something that was like, you know, Eve's Bayou or like, you know, Daughters of the... They wanted it something to be like, quote unquote, elevated. Yeah. But also, why can't we have fun? Like, I think that going back to the black women comedians, we can have fun. We can make fun of ourselves. Like, it's allowed. Mm-hmm. And I think black women have such a weight to carry that we have to be quote unquote strong. We have to be the stoic ones. And we have to like kind of carry the representation for the race, you know? So,
but I'm there with you. I think of black female comedians, and like the only one from the 90s that really comes to mind is Wanda Sykes, who was in everything.
Yes.
Right? So it's like, and now we have like a cavalcade that we can now pick from. But yeah, in the 80s, 90s, all I can think of is her, really.
And like I think that also, you know, Niecy and Mickey show like such a great humanity where like they're morally good girls. And I think I read, I can't remember what article it was, but they were saying like nobody takes advantage of these two women sexually.
Yeah.
Nobody calls them any kind of derogatory names. Like there's no racial epithets or anything thrown at them. And that no one questions that they've befriended this older white man. And I think that's there's a purity to the story, even though Troy Bayer doesn't like the film. It's not exploitative.
But the other thing is that Martin Landau never has any sexual interest in either of these women. That's never there. Did he have, they say that possibly there was a romantic tie between him and the woman whose granddaughter Halle Berry is pretending to be, Lily. But there's any talk about, you know, he never sexualizes her. He never discusses. It's just, she was my friend and I miss her. And that's really interesting. And you don't see that in a lot of movies now.
Oh, the soundtracks too. Both have really incredible soundtracks.
Yeah.
And I just think that the comparison between the two films, Lisa Kudrow did sitcoms, Natalie Dessel did sitcoms. They both have Mean Girls, they have to prove wrong. They have to, a mean nephew, they have to prove wrong. It's just so crazy. And I think BAPS came out before Romy and Michelle.
Barely.
A month. Yeah. They were a month apart. So I just think now every sleepover needs to have these two movies and play them back to back. Okay,
I agree. Now the only thing that I have, only minor point of contention, feminist messaging that I have with this is that it's saying, "Hey, take on the deadbeat husband and make him better." That I'm like, nope. Walk away from that. These men are not worth your time. You guys are very cool businesswomen. Walk away. That's the only point of contention I have of this movie. Where I'm like, bad messaging there. Shouldn't take him back.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I think those guys were kind of like, they're dead weight. And I mean, he did clean up his act, but then, you know, who's to say what he would have done because they got the money.
And so, also, quite frankly, we get that fantastic scene of Butler trying to speak with the language and translate back and forth, which is always one of my favorite things. It was really delightful. It's very well written and very well performed.
He says, "You're tripping because you're in Hollywood and he hopes you don't get played."
All right. On that note, I think we should bring this episode to a close. Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to thank Carolyn for talking about BAPS, because obviously this was going to be two different films, or I think Romy and Michelle was something else. And there was a moment where I was like, BAPS, Carolyn. Didn't even know BAPS. If you liked it, just sent the email and the explosive, enthusiastic response to, because we had agreed to do something else with you, and you're like, "No, BAPS," and it was really exciting. So thank you.
I bought it. I got it at the drugstore. I was like, it's always been in the back of my head, and I look, and I thought of the drugstore, and I'm like, "Give me that movie!" And I bought it for like, I don't know.
This is the best pharmacy film ever. Like a pharmacy bin of DVDs. Right. That's pretty good.
Yep.
And Carolyn Moore said, "Of course, thank you for joining us. I'm glad you could be here."
Oh, thank you so much. I love you both. Oh,
it's so much
thank
fun.
You for asking me to talk about this movie. Oh, my life is made.
We wouldn't have anybody else. Now tell people where they can hear your enthusiasm on your other shows and other things you do.
Oh my God. So I'm a co-host Really Melanated with Ashley Blackwell. We talk about movies we love that center Black people or Black directors. What else? Oh, I've got a website that I neglected for like a month. It's called A View from the Dark. I just talk about films of representation, specifically in genre film. So, yeah. And I'm on the Twitter, at VFD Pixie. Yeah.
And you're the programmer of Blood in the Snow.
Yes, we just wrapped up another great year at Blood in the Snow. It was really great. We did our first horror lab where we kind of got some great treatments packages from underrepresented filmmakers. So they really enjoyed it, and we were really pleased with the results. So
yay. Congrats.
and I have to shout out to Kelly Michael Stewart, the festival director, and his partner, Sarah. They did an amazing job this year. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Nice. Thank you so much, Carolyn. And you can join us next week where we look at two movies that are playful, zany, and a lot of fun. That's Cats Don't Dance and Mouse Hunt. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Alicia Fletcher and Carolyn Morissette as guests.
Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant was Ryan Mains. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.